From Oklahoma to South Carolina, California to Michigan, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, as leftist governments take over more Latin American countries, oil supplies from those nations become less dependable. Merrill Matthews from the Institute for Policy Innovation is here to explore. Congress is having a Merry Christmas with our money as a giant omnibus spending bill distributes goodies to a wide range of special interests. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. It is no longer in the headlines, but there continues to be a shortage of baby formula, and lobbyists for the industry are making matters worse. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine reports. And the holiday classic Home Alone is peppered with Christian symbolism. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College has details on this week's American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. From Mexico to Venezuela, oil production in Latin America has been declining as the policies of leftist governments destroy their nation's energy industries. Merrill Matthews is a resident scholar at the Institute for Policy Innovation. He is here to discuss the potential impact on the American consumer. Merrill, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Merrill, when we talk about energy production throughout Latin America, Mexico, and through South America, how much energy is produced by that region of the world?
Well, there's quite a bit. At least in the past there had been. Mexico is a major producer, as is Venezuela, has the largest proven oil reserves in the world. And then, of course, Brazil is a major oil producer. So, and we've had connections with them prior to the sort of economic collapse of Venezuela as it moved to a socialist country. Venezuela provided the U.S. with around 700,000 to 800,000 barrels of oil a day. Mexico provided some to the U.S., and we, in fact, southern part of Texas in the Gulf Coast, was the primary refiner for Mexico's oil. They would ship it to the Gulf Coast. We would refine it and ship it back to them. So we've had close connections with Latin America and its oil production, and that has been helpful both to them and to us for decades.
Let's talk about some of the countries in Latin America individually. And of course, Venezuela usually comes out as the most important topic. You referenced the fact they once were a major oil producer. They are not now. What happened there?
What happened with socialism and Hugo Chavez? Yes, they produce very little oil right now. In fact, they have gone back apparently into an agreement with the United States to help them crank up their production. Essentially, they did what a lot of leftist socialist countries do, which is they said, these are our resources. We should be producing them ourselves rather than have contracting with companies and expertise from other countries. And that's what they did. They basically took possession of the assets that a lot of U.S. and other countries' oil manufacturers had in there, and oil producers, and took it over themselves. They didn't have the expertise. They didn't have the knowledge to do it. And it, of course, became a government-run deal, and the oil production declined dramatically. And the ability to be able to fix units, to fix refineries, to fix the production just declined. And so Venezuela basically survived on oil revenue. So during the early 2000s, when oil prices were high and Hugo Chavez was in, he was able to do a lot of mischief with that money. Now that when oil prices declined there around the pandemic, it just really dramatically hurt the economy of not only Venezuela, but other countries there that produce oil.
Are we still receiving significant oil from Mexico, or has the reciprocal refining, shipping back and forth of oil, has that ended, or is it still taking place?
Well, Mexico has declined somewhat since it's back about 10 years ago, Mexico had decided to start partnering with the U.S. companies to help it produce oil, and that helped significantly increase their production. But and Andres Manuel Lopez Obrador, the president of Mexico has decided to take that back over and have Mexico begin to take over that again. And so their production has decreased by, I think, about a third or two-thirds. It's decreased a good bit. And the problem that we're concerned about is you have more, you have the expansion of leftist governments in Latin America. You have it in Argentina, you have it in Colombia, we already mentioned Venezuela, and Brazil was a major oil producer, didn't produce as much as Mexico or Venezuela in their heyday, but still was a major oil producer, and now that Jair Bolsonaro is gone and Lula is in, Brazil has typically kept a strong oil producing even under Lula in the past, but we don't know if that's going to continue now when, as leftists tend to say, we need to take over these resources and manage it ourselves.
So we have this declining production of oil out of Latin America. Also, we have the destabilized situation of Russia and their cutting off of natural gas supplies and oil to Eastern Europe. What is all this doing to the worldwide supply? Are we looking at a possible shortage going forward?
Well, I think it's entirely possible that we will see a shortage coming out of Latin America as time progresses. And, of course, we're down ourselves from our own oil production. Back around 2018-2019, we have become the world's leader in producing both crude oil and natural gas. The pandemic got the companies cutting back on that. And now you've got President Biden, which seems to want to keep that cut down. He's wanted the companies to produce more, but he just wants it for a short period of time to try to help him politically. But yeah, we're looking at some threats and the ability of Latin America to be able to produce oil and natural gas the way they had in the past. And that could just put, from the global standpoint, put more pressure on other countries that can produce to produce more, because we may be seeing that decline in the Latin American production that may be around with us for a while.
And this, of course, could have an upward impact on prices at the pump and for heating fuel here in the United States?
Absolutely. And, of course, another thing you had mentioned is that Russia, because of its expertise in being able to produce oil and natural gas, it opens the door, if the leftist countries don't want to work with the U.S., it opens the door for Russia to come in and partner with them. They had been doing that with Venezuela anyway. And so then you open up a new route for Russia to be able to have an influence in the Western Hemisphere, which is something we would really not like to see.
So particularly in Venezuela, Merrill, we have seen the collapse of the oil industry. It's been cut back in Mexico, may end up being cut back in Brazil and other countries. Is all of this helping to feed the illegal immigrant problem that we see at the southern border? Is this creating economic conditions that make folks want to leave there and come here?
Absolutely. But one of the highest paying jobs out there for what we call blue collar workers is in the oil industry. And so when you're producing oil, you have refineries and you're transporting oil and so forth, that creates jobs, high paying jobs for people who have the ability to be able to stay. As these leftist governments come in and they begin to create economic turmoil, you see the people from those countries who have lost their jobs, now they don't see any ability to be able to make an income for their families, and with the Biden policy having essentially an open door on our southern border, it is just a magnet for people to come. And, you know, a lot of these people would like to come and be Americans, but I think many of them would prefer to stay in their home country if they could get a job and they could have an economic opportunity and a reasonable government, safety, and other things. So it's in part the leftist policies, and in addition to the sort of the open arms of the Biden administration, has created this problem and it's exacerbated the immigration problem.
We have been talking with Merrill Matthews, who is resident scholar at the Institute for Policy Innovation. And Merrill, tell us a little bit about IPI.
Well, IPI was started in 1987, so we've been around a while. We're a nonprofit research institute, commonly called a think tank, and we work on a range of different policy issues, health policy, energy, technology, tax policy, intellectual property, and just some other areas. So we do a range of different think tank type issues. People can find us at IPI.org if they're interested. All of our information is available there on the website, free of charge, for consuming and sharing.
Merrill Matthews of the Institute for Policy Innovation. Merrill, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
As we wind down toward the end of the year, once again, we are joined by Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, as always, good to have you here.
Great to be back, Loman. Thanks for having me.
It is Christmas time, and in Washington, that means a lot of goodies get handed out. This by something called an omnibus. What is an omnibus?
Well, an omnibus is a federal appropriations bill that includes the funding for all the federal government. You have basically two ways that the government gets funded. The first one is mandatory spending programs. Those are all on autopilot, and you got to think about Medicare and Social Security and Medicaid and all those anti-poverty welfare benefit programs like food stamps. And then you have what's known as the discretionary element of the budget, and that includes really the defense and non-defense categories of appropriations. There are 12 subcommittees in Congress that basically have their own jurisdiction over the federal government and what's funded. And an omnibus includes all 12 of those subcommittees into one bill. The omnibus that was released this week is 4,155 pages long, and it will provide for about $1.7 trillion in spending, and then there are some budgetary effects of basically waiving statutory paygo, the way that we have to pay our debts when we spend too much, and so they're waiving that, and that'll add another $260 billion. So this entire package is just short of $2 trillion.
How is it that we come to Christmas time, the end of the year, when a budget was due back in October, and all of this spending is all at once on the table?
Well, some of these folks in Washington feel like the election is their Christmas bonus. They've got all this built-up goodies from K Street and all the hard work that they did throughout the year, and you know it's Christmas time, and now's the time to kind of go ahead and cash the check. Right now, we know that the legislation Congress is taking up is not only enormous and not only related to federal spending, but there are a bunch of different anomalies included in that that are sort of unrelated to the immediate needs of the federal government, but are added on to ensure that they can become law while Democrats hold all branches of power from the House, Senate, and White House. This bill will include emergency supplemental appropriations related to disaster spending, and it will also include money to help fund the efforts in Ukraine. Those are just a couple of the things that I think are included, and it's always good to take the Democrats for their word in terms of what they think is a win. You know, sometimes when I go and vote, I take a sample ballot from the Democrat poll watcher, and it tells me which candidates they're supporting. Well, if we look at the wins that Rosa DeLauro and the House Democrats think are included, tells us a lot of information here. And a couple of things that I think are fairly interesting are the number of earmarks that are in this bill. We know that there are 3,213 earmarks just for the Democrats, and they're so proud of themselves they fulfilled 98% of the Democrats' earmark requests. I think it's also worth noting that this bill is effectively an environmental, social, and governance bill, an ESG bill. It's got all sorts of green funding in it, and this is basically continuing the path of socialist spending that we've had since early 2021 when Democrats took power in Washington. Now, this is what's known as a lame duck omnibus, right? What that means is that you've got power in Washington that's about to split. We know that Republicans won the House majority, and in January, they're going to have some new leverage at the negotiating table. But right now, those Senate Republicans, they can't help themselves. And what they're doing is they're working with the Democrats to ensure that this becomes law before the end of the year. So I think that it's kind of important to unpack some of the crazy crap that's in here. And if I can take a moment, if that's all right with you, Loman, I'm going to just talk about a couple things, because the Senate Appropriations Committee Chairman, Patrick Leahy, he's been around for a really long time, over 30 years, and of course he's got earmarks in the bill. He's renaming the Lake Champlain Basin program to be the Patrick Leahy Lake Champlain program, and he's going to stuff $35 million every year until 2027 into that program, all underneath his name. And then you've got Dick Shelby, who's the senator from Alabama, Republican, the vice chairman of the committee, and almost everything in Alabama is already named after him, but he's renaming the FBI at Redstone Arsenal building to be known as the Richard Shelby Center for Innovation and Advanced Training. And then you have people like Nancy Pelosi, right? Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, she's lost that power, and she's on her way to being a backbench. She kind of stepped out of the leadership ranks. And what she's doing is she's renaming a building on at 97th Street in San Francisco, and now it's going to be redesignated as the Speaker Nancy Pelosi Federal Building. This is how they fund government. They're way better at than Republicans at getting their priorities tucked into bills when nobody's going to read it. And I think that the process that was really driven by the House and Senate Democrats to basically put one over on the Republicans in the Senate should be considered a win that Rosa DeLauro and all the socialist squad are happy with. Some people really saw the arrival of people like AOC to take down the Washington establishment. But as I mentioned, all those earmarks, of course, there are also earmarks for the socialist squad. AOC got millions in earmarks. Ilhan Omar got millions. Rashida Tlaib got millions. Ayanna Pressley got millions of dollars in earmarks. So let's not call them the socialist squad anymore. Let's change them to being known as the swamp squad.
We have been talking with Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, a few words about the club.
Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C. You can become a member for free. Join us in fighting for economic freedom, liberty, and opportunity at clubforgrowth.org.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Merry Christmas to you, Scott. Take care.
Merry Christmas.
The baby formula shortage continues to be a problem, and the industry itself is making it worse. To find out how and why, we turn to Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine.
Earlier this year, Americans got a painful lesson about the costs of protectionism as huge tariffs on imported baby formula contributed to a national shortage that lasted months and is in many ways still ongoing. But now Congress is being persuaded to make that same mistake all over again. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. This week, we're taking a look at how these anti-competitive protectionist rules get on the books in the first place. And there's a really good case study that's happening right in front of us at this very moment, because a big dairy, lobbyists for the U.S. dairy industry, is currently persuading Congress to put back in place the huge tariffs on imported baby formula that contributed to the big shortage that we had earlier this year. I think it's a useful bookend to a story that has been one of the bigger stories of 2022. And as we head into 2023, if Congress doesn't take action, we could be basically resetting the table all over again for another crisis like the one that we experienced earlier this year. As part of a bill that Congress passed in July, as part of its all-hands-on-deck approach to the baby formula shortage, the tariffs that normally apply to imported baby formula were temporarily discarded. But unless Congress takes further action before the end of the year, those 25% tariffs will return on the first day of 2023, and lobbyists for the American dairy industry are keen to make sure that that happens. In a letter to Congress, Jim Milhern, president and CEO of the National Milk Producers Federation, wrote last month that, quote, "Given that the temporary production shortfall that gripped American families in need of formula earlier this year has abated, we urge Congress to ensure that the unique unilateral tariff benefits end as scheduled at the close of this year." He went on to say, "We respectfully request your opposition to any effort to extend those preferential tariff benefits beyond the end of this year." Now, let's just call this what it is. It's the dairy industry asking Congress to raise taxes on baby formula at a time when many American families are still struggling to find adequate supplies. That might boost the domestic formula manufacturers' bottom lines. It might be good news for the dairy industry, of course, but it comes at the cost of making it more expensive and difficult for parents to feed their infant children, and once again, heightening the risk of a supply shortage like the one that we experienced earlier this year. And despite what the dairy industry says, the crisis hasn't really fully passed. Yes, the shortage is not as bad as it was a few months ago, and this story has kind of fallen off the front pages, but about one-third of U.S. households are still reporting having difficulty finding adequate supplies of baby formula. That's according to some weekly surveys that are done by the Census Bureau. Actually, a survey that the Census Bureau started during the COVID-19 pandemic as a way to track supply chain issues, but it's now become kind of a useful way to observe what American households are having difficulty finding in stores. And just a month ago, a top official at the Department of Agriculture told Politico that there's, quote, obviously still a problem with getting formula onto store shelves. Now, the tariffs on baby formula didn't create this mess, but it certainly made it a lot harder to solve. Let's go back to the beginning. The crisis, the baby formula shortage, began when there was suspected contamination at a Michigan factory that produces about a quarter of the supply of American baby formula. And the factory had to go offline, actually, for a number of weeks in February. So parents were left scrambling to find formula, and stores had to ration what limited supplies were available. Now, in a freer market, baby formula made elsewhere in the world could have been redirected into the United States to fill this needed demand and to ease the supply shock. And look, let's not get sidetracked by a discussion about whether the formula made in Europe is safe for babies to eat or not. Actually, most of the world's supply of baby formula is made in Europe. And when it comes to safety and health standards, the EU's regulations are actually stricter than the FDA's. Most of the major players in the baby formula market in the world are actually based in Europe. There's a major supplier in Germany, another one in the Netherlands, and another one in England. But it's very difficult to find their formula in the United States for two reasons. One is the massive tariffs that basically make those products uncompetitive in the American market. And secondly, there is kind of excessive and ridiculous FDA regulations that have to do with labeling. That has nothing to do with safety or nutrition standards. It's just a way to keep foreign-made formula off American shelves because companies don't want to jump through all the hoops to clear the FDA's regulations when, even if they did get permission to sell their product in the United States, they would still be subject to those huge tariffs. The two things work in tandem to effectively close off foreign competition from the American market. And I think this whole situation really illustrates what some nationalist conservatives misunderstand about the value of free trade, because they want to argue that protecting domestic suppliers and domestic industries with tariffs and other policies makes the United States stronger, more resilient. But in this case, I think we see how that's not true at all. It actually makes our supply chains less resilient. It makes our market less able to respond when there's a crisis because we can't quickly redirect supplies of any good from elsewhere in the world into the United States. Because this combination of regulations and tariffs prevented the market from being able to respond to the baby formula shortage, we were instead treated to that ridiculous spectacle of the Biden administration airlifting formula into the U.S. from Europe as a way to get around these regulations and tariffs. Then there were other steps that were taken, but taken far too late. Congress did, of course, temporarily lift the tariffs, and the FDA did say that it was going to ease its regulatory regime for baby formula. But those things didn't happen until mid-summer, months after this crisis was obvious, and months after American parents were scrambling to find baby formula. And I think there's a lesson there about how politics lags behind the market and lags behind the economy when it comes to responding to these types of situations. Congress should reject the dairy industry's attempt to weaken America's baby formula supply chains all over again. Big Dairy doesn't need another Christmas present, and we don't need to repeat the lessons of 2022 once again in 2023. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. You can check out more of our coverage of this issue and everything else going on around the country this week at Reason.com, and catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Home Alone is truly a Christmas film, filled with many images of the reason for the season. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College has details on this American Radio Journal commentary.
If you're looking for a Christmas movie for the family this year, I'm going to suggest an obvious favorite, but for reasons perhaps less obvious. The movie is Home Alone. And the unexpected reasons? Well, listen up. And as I share these explicitly Christian elements of the movie, please understand that it is, well, a Christmas movie after all. So that should be okay. Released in November 1990 for the Thanksgiving and holiday theater rush, Home Alone became an instant Christmas classic. Its main star, Macaulay Culkin, who plays Kevin, became a household name. The film was directed by Chris Columbus and produced and written by the wonderful John Hughes. Speaking of wonderful, it also featured the work of John Williams, who composed Somewhere in My Memory, the theme song of the film. Home Alone is a rare modern movie that the entire family, from 5 years old to 50, can watch and enjoy. And yet, what strikes me every time I watch the film are the Christian elements. The first clear indication of that comes when Kevin is out and about after being left home. Fleeing from the burglars, with whom we'll have an epic home invasion encounter later, Kevin finds refuge in, of all places, a manger. He hides in a large creche outside a church. He's protected. One of the burglars, looking for Kevin from his van window, says, "Maybe he went into the church." "I'm not going in there," responds the other tellingly. "Me neither," concedes his partner in crime. "The church is not a place for the two bad guys." The next time that Kevin is threatened in the film, he again finds refuge at the church, but this time inside, and it's a pivot point in the story. Inside, Kevin unexpectedly comes face to face with the scary old man who lives next door, who Kevin's nasty brother Buzz had convinced him is a closet serial killer. This is one of the most poignant scenes in the movie. Kevin entered the sanctuary to the comforting sounds of a children's choir rehearsing "O Holy Night." Kevin passes St. Francis and other symbols of Christmas. He takes a seat in a pew. Suddenly, he's struck by the sight of the approaching old neighbor, who suddenly isn't so scary anymore. "Merry Christmas," the neighbor warmly greets the boy, gentlemanly asking him, "May I sit down?" Kevin agrees, not afraid anymore. He talks. He opens up. He tells the old man that he's feeling bad. The old man says, "Well," looking around at the church environs, "this is the place to be if you're feeling bad about yourself." The two have a heart-to-heart about families and loving your family. The old man says he doesn't feel welcome by his family. "I'm not welcome." "At a church?" says Kevin incredulously. "No," corrects the man, "we're all welcome at church." The problem, he explains, is his severed relationship with his son. "You should call your son," Kevin urges. Thanks to this pivotal conversation, the old man will eventually do just that. "Merry Christmas," says the old man again when he departs. It's after this apparent preparation in the church that Kevin goes home and readies for battle. "This is my house," he announces, "and I have to defend it." He lays out a literal battle plan drawn up on paper. He sits down for a final meal between two golden angel figurines, makes the sign of the cross, says grace, and then heads into combat. In the end, Kevin wins with the crucial help of the old man next door. Indeed, the final scene of the movie is one of mercy, forgiveness, and reconciliation. Kevin looks out the window and sees his neighbor, the old man, embracing his family, granddaughter, daughter-in-law, and his estranged son. He must have taken Kevin's advice in the church. Kevin smiles and waves to him from the window. And yet, that's not the last image in the film. The camera closes with an image slightly blurred. You have to watch it carefully. I think most people miss it. As the film focuses on Kevin and zooms closer, there's a background image of a cross over his left shoulder. It's so subtle that it's easy to miss. For secular audiences, it had to be subtle, one supposes. Nonetheless, there it is. The cross is the film's final message and image. It's also the message and image of the Christ child. Merry Christmas, truly, the message of Home Alone. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including KJAAAM in Globe, Arizona, WMCE-FM in Erie, Pennsylvania, along with WFLJ-AM in Greenville, South Carolina. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. From all of us at American Radio Journal, our best wishes for a blessed Christmas and a prosperous New Year.